Are animals our equals? And what does that mean?
Animals think, feel, and know. Animals even have senses that we have lost or never attained. And they deserve our affection and our respect.
That's celebrated author Cy Montgomery. She talks with us about the essays she and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas have written and collected in a wonderful new book, Tamed and Untamed, Close Encounters of the Animal Kind. Then we hear part of our 2011 interview with Elizabeth Tova Bailey about her book, The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Did you know that many animals have names for the humans they know, or that they laugh? Some of them even rock out to our music. Some lions settle down to watch the sunset every night and roar when it dips below the horizon. These and many other examples in the new book, Tamed and Untamed, by Cy Montgomery and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, show the depth of animal thought and feeling. Actually, I should say the other animals, because, of course, we are animals too. And this is exactly what Montgomery and Thomas point out in the essays penned by them that they've gathered together for the book Tamed and Untamed. Drawing on stories of animals both wild and domestic, as diverse as snails, house cats, hawks, sharks, dogs, lions, and octopuses, the book shows that the more we learn about what other animals think and feel, the more we understand ourselves as animals too. Cy Montgomery is the author of many books for adults and children, including The Soul of an Octopus and The Good Good Pig. Her co-author, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, is one of the most widely read authors on anthropology and animals, both wild and domestic. Her many books include Dreaming of Lions and The Hidden Life of Dogs. Well, Cy Montgomery, welcome to Writer's Voice.
I'm delighted to be on. Thank you.
I missed a chance to talk with you about your acclaimed book, The Soul of the Octopus, so I was so glad when this new book came across my transom, the book that you co-wrote with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, who we've also interviewed, this book, Tamed and Untamed. First of all, just tell us, how did this work come about and why?
Well, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas and I have been best friends for 32 years last month. We met when I had moved to New Hampshire, having lived for 6 months in a tent in the outback studying emus. And my husband and I knew no one. He saw an article in the newspaper about this really cool lady who lived the next town over, who had worked with Katie Tain to discover infrasound in elephants. The fact that elephants can communicate over vast distances using sounds that we can't hear. And he said, you know, you should meet this person. Well, I had a column at the time in a newspaper called New Hampshire Times, and so I had a good excuse to call her up and interview her. I went over to her house, and instantly we realized that despite a considerable age difference and despite the fact that she was magnificently accomplished and I was just starting my career, that we were really kindred spirits. She was already, when in the 50s, before I was walking, much less reading, she was already a finalist for the National Book Award for her amazing book of living with the sand bushmen in Namibia called The Harmless People. But when I first interviewed her, I didn't know that about her. I just knew about the connection with elephants. And I had been to Africa on research expeditions before, and we just had so much to talk about. And ever since then, she's been my first reader on everything I've written. I've been her first reader on everything she's written. She has written forewords for my stuff. I have written blurbs for her stuff. She's blurbed my things. We're in each other's books. She's a major character in one of my nationally best-selling books, The Good Good Pig. And we just had never written a book together. And this book is a collection of essays that we have written individually, but they're together for the first time in book form. And it's such a wonderful thing to have this out and have our names next to each other on the cover.
That's a great story. And this book, you know, the essays in it are all directed towards one very important purpose, and that is to get human beings to climb down off our pedestal and realize something about the creatures that we share this world with. What is that?
Well, that is that animals think, feel, and know. Animals even have senses that we have, in Henry Beston's words, lost or never attained. And they deserve our affection and our respect and our compassion. And, you know, you totally got it when you said, you know, it's time to climb off our pedestal. It's not even a good or fun place to live on a pedestal. It's so much better to be embedded in a family, which is really what we are with the other animals. You look at fish, you know, we are basically, says Dilbert, fish plus time. There's a wonderful book by Neil Shubin that is called Your Inner Fish. I mean, and think of the mammals. I mean, all placental mammals share 90% of our DNA. We really are a family, and I think it's, and Liz agrees, that it's not just foolish, but dangerous for us to pretend that we're not embedded in this family.
Dangerous?
Well, take a look at what we've done to the earth. It's like, oh, people against animals. I'll just throw pollution in the ocean because it's just going to kill a bunch of whales and fish. So what? Well, guess what? We end up eating all of that. By 2050, there will be more plastic in the ocean than fish.
Oh.
And there was recently a report showing that pollution of all kinds is, it kills more people every year around the world than AIDS and tuberculosis and malaria combined.
Wow.
And we used to think pollution was just something that, you know, wasn't good for the fish, or it wasn't good if some seal got caught in it, or it made birds' eggshells thin, and gee, that was too bad, but we had to do progress. Well, what's not good for the natural world isn't good for us either.
Yeah, you also talk about this mindset of anthropodenial, about the universality of consciousness. And this wonderful book, Tamed and Untamed, is really about the kinds of consciousness that we share with other animals, some remarkable stories which we'll get to very soon. But first I want to ask you, what kind of evidence? I mean, you have studied many, many animals. You've been around people who do the studying of those animals. What is the evidence that animals have consciousness? And, you know, to me, this is like a no-brainer. But
right.
Yeah.
Right. If you have a dog or a cat or even a fish who you pay any attention to, you know they do. But there's tons of, well, first we should talk about consciousness itself, because consciousness is a construct. It is not necessarily something that can be measured by a device to see if it's there or not. We all think we are conscious, but there are philosophers and scientists who say that the idea of consciousness is a fiction. But if we set that aside, if we decide, okay, I have consciousness, consciousness is a thing, what are some of its components? Well, again, scientists and philosophers and neurologists, neuroscientists disagree, but on some things they do agree, and that is, can you learn? Can you remember? Is there evidence of intelligence? Is there a mind there? Now, when we're asleep, we are not conscious, but your mind is still there. So you can still keep splitting hairs ad infinitum. But one piece of evidence, one of the many pieces of evidence that I find extremely compelling for consciousness, if we're going to say consciousness is definitely something humans have, if you look at the neurochemical basis of our emotions, for example, you can see spikes in certain hormones and neurotransmitters during certain emotional states. Oxytocin is one of them, the cuddle hormone that it's called. And it's a hormone that helps us to bond with our children and our mates and groups of people and other species who we love. Well, you look in almost any organism, in fact, any organism that has been tested, has a version of that neurochemical, which is responsible for something that we hold very dear and consider to be an important part of what it means to be human and what it means to be conscious. And even octopuses, who, unlike humans, don't give live birth, they lay eggs, unlike humans, don't suckle their young, and oxytocin is considered to also be responsible for milk letdown, yet they have a hormone so like oxytocin, they call it cephalotocin for cephalopods. Mm. And every other one of those neurotransmitters that's associated with brain states that we experience as humans has been found in other critters. And I get that information from Dr. Jennifer Mather, who has a great phrase that you can just say when people want to argue with you. You can say, well, neurotransmitters are highly conserved across taxa. That usually shuts people up.
Hi, what is it? Neurotransmitters are highly conserved across taxa?
Yeah, isn't that great?
I love it. That's not taxa reform, is it?
Boy, that is very funny. Taxa reform. That's a really good thing, good joke for my biologist friends.
So, yeah, so what you're saying is that basically we all share these chemicals that are chemicals that were evolved to be connected with emotions.
That's right. That's right. And there was actually in 2012 a convention of neuroscientists, neurobiologists, folks who study the brain, and they signed essentially a declaration. It was called the Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness. And they said, and it was a ton of luminaries who signed this thing, they said that the neural substrate necessary to generate consciousness is present in all mammals and birds and probably in cephalopods as well, specifically octopuses.
And insects, no?
Boy, I don't know if insects were in there. They are invertebrates. Mm-hmm. So little is known about insects. I mean, when you think that there are still people out there saying that, you know, rats' lives don't matter, they don't have feeling, they don't have emotions, you can subject them to any kind of torture in a laboratory. There's still folks saying that. Mm-hmm. No wonder people haven't looked into the intellectual experiences of insects. Because, you know, a bug, people think nothing of squashing a bug. And not all bugs, most bugs are what we consider, you know, insects, are actually beneficial to us. But people think, oh, it's a nuisance, let's just kill it. Liz Thomas makes the point that, you know, we look up in the sky and we see this magnificent eagle. Well, if it were as tiny as a bug, we'd swat it.
Mm. That's a good point. And about rats, by the way, you know, you say that they're as smart and as affectionate as dogs. I had an experience where, this is several years ago, a friend of my son's had a rat, and then he couldn't take care of it anymore. It had a huge abscess. The poor thing was really just, you know, weeks from the end of its life. But we took it in, and it was just astonishing. I didn't know just how affectionate these creatures are, how responsive it was to us. It clearly understood that we were trying to ease its pain, you know, and I'd like to think we gave it a more, you know, it kind of came to us as, at the hospice stage, but I like to think we eased its transition into another form of existence. But
God, I'm sure you did. Not many people would do that. You're very special.
Well, I just was so struck by how clearly this rat had intelligence. You say rats actually understand words.
Oh, they totally understand words. I mean, tons of animals understand words. They totally understand words. They laugh. We don't hear their laughter, but like elephant infrasound, it's at a frequency we don't hear. They laugh under the same circumstances we do. They laugh when they're tickled. Rats make an appearance in a couple of essays in Tamed and Untamed, and in one of them, we briefly see a rat's dream. Because when rats run mazes, you can put electrodes on their heads and see, you know, specific patterns that occur when they are turning left on this part of the maze, running over here, walking over there. And when they dream about the same stuff we do. They dream about their daily lives and the things that they have to consolidate in their memories. And so during this experiment, researchers found that rats were dreaming of running the maze. And they could even see, by comparing those patterns, they were identical to the patterns that they got when the animal was awake and running the maze.
Wow. You know, another thing that you say, Cy Montgomery, in this book that you co-authored with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, Tamed and Untamed, is that we name animals, of course, but that animals also name us.
Yes, I think this is so exciting. It's so cool. I actually originally began to think about this issue thanks to Melissa Cowie, who has written a great book called How to Speak Chicken. Well, I met her at a AAAS meeting, American Association for the Advancement of Science, and we were both getting awards for our books. And her previous book was also about chickens. And I have a flock who appear in the book several times. And she started telling me that when she walks into their coop, they make a vocalization unlike any that she had ever heard in any other flock, and they only do it at the moment that they see her. Well, we figured it out. That's their name for her. Yeah. And they aren't the only animals who use proper names. We know for a fact, for instance, that dolphins have signature whistles to identify each other. And Liz, who has studied wolves on Baffin Island, says that wolves' howls also identify each caller.
Well, you know, it just occurred to me, this makes so much sense because our animals recognize our names for them. If they didn't have names for us, I mean, they wouldn't even have the concept of a proper name to understand our names for them.
Right. I think that makes complete sense.
Now, you also say, you know, I mean, we're just talking about the things that animals are that we have in common with them. Of course, they're far more skilled than we in many ways as well. But something was very interesting. You talk about how animals, like, for example, bears, use plants as medicines.
Oh, yeah. There was a real interesting article I was reading showing that even insects use plants as medicines. There's a lot of animals. It was documented in chimpanzees, for example. It's been known in sheep. We don't think of sheep as being really smart, but when they start getting something wrong with their stomachs, they go and they eat a specific type of plant. And, you know, how do they know to do this? It probably the same way that we do, by experimenting, or maybe by watching others. And it's been claimed by Native Americans for many years that the original medicine woman or medicine man was a bear, which means that they learned from watching bears what medicines are good. And boy, were they smart, as we know. Bears will methodically strip the bark from willow trees and chew that up. And there's no nutrition in the willow tree, but what's in the bark is salicylic acid, which is the same molecule that is making aspirin an effective pain reliever and something that takes down inflammation. So they know that.
Now, there are some other anecdotes or stories, because these are a series of, you know, short vignettes in Tamed and Untamed, that point up the aesthetic appreciation, the aesthetic qualities of animals. And I'd like to talk about two of them. One is Snowball the cockatoo, because after I read about Snowball, I went and watched the video online.
Oh, wasn't that awesome? God, if you're having a bad day, folks, just watch this video and you will smile ear to ear. Didn't you love it?
Yeah, and what joy.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, they experience joy just like we do, and we often can see it. Mm-hmm. But there's times when we can't see it because we haven't learned how to look. But boy, Snowball certainly makes it obvious that he's having a blast.
So tell our listeners about Snowball.
Well, Snowball is a cockatoo who a family couldn't keep for an interest. There's an interesting reason behind that. Anyway, he fell in love with the young girl who adopted him, and when she went off to college, he assumed that she'd been eaten by an owl, because, you know, if your mate doesn't come back, it's because somebody ate them. They really do mate for life, unlike humans. And then when she came back, he was so furious at her for leaving that he would attack her. Mm. So he got dropped off at Bird Lovers Only Bird Rescue, and he came with a CD. Well, Bird Lovers Only gets a lot of rescued animals, and they have a very busy day there. So Irina Schultz, who runs the rescue, didn't have a chance to play the CD right away. But when she did and saw what Snowball did, she completely went crazy. He rocked out to this CD. It was the Backstreet Boys singing their song Everybody. And he raised his crest, he marched on his feet, he threw his head around, he opened and closed his wings, and he screamed and he sang, but he also did it in time to the music. Then this struck Irina Schultz, who's actually a scientist herself, as something worthy of investigation. And so Ani Patel, who wrote a beautiful book called Music in the Brain, he's a neuroscientist now at Tufts, went to see if birds actually do have this cognitive ability, which is usually ascribed to higher minds, called beat perception and synchronization. We understand the beat to music, and we can synchronize with it, so much so that you almost can't help tapping your feet sometimes to a good tune. But other animals were thought to not have this because it was a property, it was thought, of so-called higher minds. But parrots certainly have it. He has documented this in a ton of other parrots. He has had people just kind of score their videoed dancing behavior and then comparing it to the music later, and found that they have an excellent way of anticipating that next beat. It's a very sophisticated cognitive ability when you think of it, because you have to not only perceive but anticipate that there is a beat. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever danced with a lousy dancer, you realize that not all humans have it so great.
you have to discern patterns.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. And birds are very sophisticated at this. And interestingly, I mean, Ani says that this may be a characteristic of vocal learning, the kind of characteristic that allows us, for example, to use language. And language, for the longest time, was thought to be one of the many Rubicons people keep devising to keep animals and humans separated. But it turns out we're not separate from animals. We both enjoy dancing. I spent my birthday one year rocking out with Snowball the Dancing Cockatoo. I picked a song and we danced to it together, and it was so much fun. He really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. And I started picking up his lead. You know, when you're dancing, I don't know if other people are old enough to remember, for example, ballroom dancing, in mm-hmm. which the male partner is supposed to lead. Well, I learned that kind of dancing as well as a more modern dancing. But even when you're doing modern dancing in which partners don't touch, often you do pick up your partner's lead. And I realized I was picking up Snowball's. And I realized this not just from what I felt, but Irina's husband videotaped me dancing with Snowball. And later, I could see with the music turned off that I was indeed following his lead.
That's wonderful. Now, speaking of aesthetics, there's another really beautiful story in the book that you tell about lions. You mentioned Katie Payne, who discovered that infrasound, is that what you called it?
Elephant
communication.
Elephant, yeah. Mm-hmm.
She also, she had a number of remarkable experiences with lions, but the one I'd like you to talk to us about is about the lion and the sunset.
Oh, well, this was actually something that Liz wrote about and Liz observed. Liz observed a lion roaring at the very moment that the sun sank beneath the horizon. And the lion had been lying there watching the sun sink. So it meant something to that lion to be seeing the sun, and it meant something when it disappeared beneath the horizon. The lion had some kind of an emotional response to that. And I think that many animals perceive beauty, including beauty that we don't appreciate. I mean, dogs, for example, can encounter a big pile of excrement and think that's just great, and we fail to appreciate it. But animals may appreciate some of the same kinds of beauty, visual beauty, oral beauty, the beauty of a lovely smell that we do as well.
What was also interesting about the lion and the sunset is, and yes, this was an essay by Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, was that it was peculiar to this community of lions, the Etosha lions. It wasn't just this lion. Other lions in that community also would watch the sunset and roar. But other lions don't. So this is kind of a layered observation, not just appreciation of beauty, but a cultural value.
Yeah, absolutely. Animals do have culture, and this has been documented over and over and over. The same species does not behave the same way in different places, just like humans.
My next question is funny. I was looking it over, and I realized there might even be kind of a bias in it. But here we go. You wrote The Soul of an Octopus, and one of the octopi that you write about in the book is Octavia, who also appears in this book, Tamed and Untamed. And I wanted to ask you, this was my question, what did Octavia teach you about intelligence that could be seen as to be equal to our own? So I do want you to answer that, but I also realize that there's kind of a bias in it, which is that other animals who aren't like dolphins or whales or octopi or parrots, maybe their intelligence is no really less than our own, it's just different.
Yeah, I think you are so right. That is so on the ball. Liz and I frequently see animals' intelligence compared to that of children, for example. People have said, you know, a pig is as smart as a 3-year-old child or something like this. And that just really demeans animals. Mm-hmm. An octopus can't do all the stuff that a 3-year-old child can do intellectually. But as one other researcher pointed out, if you lop off that child's arm, how many colors can it turn in half a second? And can it go out and hunt and capture something to eat? No, of course not. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's not something that you can really compare. So much of an animal's intelligence is there so the animal can do its job in the world. And our jobs in the world often entail things like, constructing buildings, writing books, driving a car. And you would not want your dog or pig or octopus at least driving a car. and they don't want to either. But can I taste with my skin? No. There's only one piece of my skin I can taste with, and that is my tongue, and I can't taste nearly as much about the world as an octopus can. Can I pour my body through a tiny opening the size of an orange? No, but a 100-pound octopus can. There's so many things that they can do that we can't, and there are many things that we can do that they can't. But what struck me the most about the octopus's intelligence and how it is like ours is that they can look up through the water and recognize me as an individual with, I presume, thoughts and feelings, an individual who they choose to come over and visit with and play with.
And also trick.
That's right. They can deceive. Boy, are they good at deceiving. But yeah, Octavia totally tricked a whole crowd of people. This was right after she came, actually. She'd only been at the aquarium a few weeks, and I had only interacted with her once before. And I went with a group of folks with Living on Earth, an environmental radio show here in Boston. They wanted to do a piece on octopus intelligence. So we took them behind the scenes at the New England Aquarium. Bill Murphy, the senior aquarist, opened up Octavia's tank. And she came over and was playing with us. We were feeding her fish. We were petting her. We were letting her suck on us. We were just lost in the sensation of watching her change color and shape and what she felt like. And then we thought, you know what, it would be fun to give her another fish. And we looked around. The bucket was gone. And with all these people standing around, most of them touching her, she had managed to steal that bucket right from out from under our noses. And I think she was just laughing. Interestingly, she didn't even seem to want the fish in it. She just was playing with the bucket.
That's so amazing. And hiding it, you said.
Yes, she hid it underneath her. It's easy for her to hide things. They have an interbrachial web between their arms, right, almost like an umbrella, and they can hide stuff under there.
It's so
and she was a riot. God, she was a lovely, lovely octopus. She had a sense of humor, I think. So did Kali, another octopus that I knew. They're so distinctive. You know, there's folks that will say, oh, you're anthropomorphizing, that octopus didn't recognize you, didn't know you. Not true, because Roland Anderson and Jennifer Mather did studies at Seattle Aquarium with octopuses, and they dressed people in identical outfits, and half the people had a bristly stick, half the people had a delicious fish. And the octopuses very quickly got to recognize, just by looking up through the water at them, not even by touching or tasting the people, which ones had brought them the delicious fish and which ones had touched them with the bristly stick. And how do we know? Because they would advance happily to meet the people who had the delicious fish, even if they left the delicious fish at home. They were happy to see those people, even if they weren't carrying the item. And those who had touched them with the bristly stick, they would move away, they would do camouflage behaviors around their eyes, and some of them would blast those people in the face with icy cold salt water.
Wow.
Yeah. So they do recognize individual people. And when you think of this, and how hard it is for many people to recognize individual animals, we don't have our eyes on yet to recognize differences. But if you look carefully, you're going to see them, and they will eventually become obvious.
So do you think that this awareness of the animal consciousness, you know, co-equal with us? And there are people who say that trees also have consciousness.
Oh, yeah. There's a fabulous new book out called The Hidden Life of Trees, which is fantastic. And it talks about the wood wide web, how trees communicate, and they do communicate through the mycelia of fungi and transmit information just like our internet.
So do you think that this message is getting out? Do you see a shift in our consciousness about it?
Yes. Yes, I definitely do. I mean, our politics have yet to catch up with that. Our laws have yet to catch up with much of it. But there is a huge change that I've seen just in my lifetime, and that Liz has seen even more so. She's 86. I am 59. She's seen an even bigger change. But we kind of have it in us to realize this, you know, because until, evolutionarily speaking, quite recently, we were hunter-gatherers, and you had to pay attention to nature, or you would find nothing to eat, or someone would come and eat you. And when we were hunter-gatherers, and when Liz was in Namibia studying the Bushmen, no one questioned that animals had thoughts and feelings and made plans and decisions and cared about their lives.
Right. Well, Cy Montgomery, it has just been such a joy to speak with you about this wonderful book that you co-authored, really a collection of vignettes that you and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas have written and put now together, Tamed and Untamed. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you.
Cy Montgomery is the author of many books, including The Soul of an Octopus and The Good Good Pig. Read an excerpt from Tamed and Untamed at writersvoice.net. You can also find a video there of the cockatoo Snowball dancing. And you can find a link to our interview with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas about her book, Dreaming of Lions. Next up, Elizabeth Tova Bailey's friendship with a snail. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. One of our previous guest Cy Montgomery's favorite books about animals is Elizabeth Tova Bailey's book, The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. We spoke with Bailey back in 2011 about that book. Here's an excerpt from that interview. Elizabeth Tova Bailey, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating is a story of a friendship, I guess one would say, that develops between you and a snail, and I'm assuming that the snail partook in it as well. You got very sick while on a trip to the Alps, and this is what frames the story of your book. Tell us what happened to you.
Well, I just came down with sort of flu-like symptoms and some muscles that weren't working right and just got very, very sick and managed to make it onto the plane and get back home, but had just a very severe illness that went on for many, many months. I was actually down for close to bedridden for almost 9 months and then some very slow improvement over a couple more years, back up maybe to 80%, and then I had a whole other complete relapse, and a lot of relapse after that. And one of the very severe relapses, when I was bedridden again, a friend came to visit with a pot of violets she had dug up outdoors, and she had been out for a walk and picked up a snail and put the snail into the pot of violets. It was a snail from the forest, from the woods, mm-hmm. along the coast of Maine. And she brought it into my room, and I was, you know, exhausted from having had a visitor and wasn't sure why she had brought it in. I was even kind of a little bit grumpy about it, maybe, because she was just going to leave it there, and I didn't know what I was supposed to do with a snail in my bedroom.
Here was, you were flat on your back, and here's a pet you have to take care of.
Right, and I couldn't even get up to get a meal or take care of my dog or anything else. And she just drove off, and so I was, you know, I'm just lying there, and the snail was in its shell. I wasn't even totally sure it was alive or that there was anything in the shell. And then around in the evening, it came out of its shell and started to explore. And with nothing else to do, I just started to watch it, you know, thinking, what am I going to do with this? But also watching what it was doing. And it was very curious about what was around it because it was suddenly in a new environment. And I went to sleep thinking, well, when I wake up, it'll be gone, and I don't know where it'll be, and, you know, what's going to happen to it. But when I woke up in the morning, it had gone back up into the pot of violets and gone to sleep under one of the violet leaves for the day, because as I was to discover, snails are nocturnal. And so it did this then every day. It would go off exploring in the evening and throughout the night and then go back and sleep in the violet pot in the morning and all day. And when you watch an animal, you sort of become part of its life. You start to bond with it. You realize that it likes all the things you like, a good place to sleep and something delicious to eat and some adventures. And that just was a very... it was very comforting to have this little creature going about its life every day right next to me 24 hours a day.
You know, I think I probably anthropomorphized a little bit up in the beginning, saying that, you know, I assume that the snail also entered into it. But you became very bonded, as you say, with the snail. Did you have any indication that it knew about you?
No, I didn't. I would think about that once in a while. I would wonder. And, well, when I say that it didn't, you know, I'm sure it didn't know that I was a human being and anything about the human life. But snails, unlike humans, they only have three senses, not five. They have taste and smell and touch. And there's no question that it probably would have smelled all kinds of new things in the room in a house, including a human. And that would have been how it would have known that I was there. And I was on one side, you know, it was living on the right side of my bed. So it definitely would have known that there was something on the other side of where it was living, but, you know, wouldn't have known what. But they are very, very aware of anything that's new or different and where a smell is coming from, where a vibration, if I rolled over in bed, it would have felt vibrations from that.
Yeah, and the snail, as you describe it in your book, The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating, I mean, that was almost the first sound indication that you in fact had of it, or the first thing that really alerted you to it. Is that right?
Well, I had been watching it for a couple of evenings, mm-hmm. And then watching it sleep during the day, and then I woke up one morning and there were some little square holes in some envelopes and lists that I had left, you know, right at my bedside. And I couldn't think where they had come from. And then I realized that it must have been the snail, and the snail must be hungry. And so there were some flowers that had gone by in a vase, and I put a petal down by the snail one night, and the snail started to eat the petal. It clearly was really hungry, and to my astonishment, if I listened really carefully, I could actually hear it eating. And that was just, you know, I had been ill for so long and through so many relapses over so many years and so helpless when I was totally bedridden. And here I was able to feed this little animal and actually sustain it. And that was just a very wonderful feeling. I think one of the hardest things about being ill is not only can you not do the things you love or the things you need and want to do, like work, a normal job, and you can't socialize and stay connected to people, and there's very few ways in which you can ever help anybody else. I couldn't even help my dog. I couldn't take my dog for walks, but I was able to sort of caretake this little snail. And after that, I would listen at night to hear if it was eating, and, you know, periodically I would hear it eating, and that was very comforting. It was a very intimate little sound.
Mm-hmm. Now, you never do mention in the book what job you had. You make a number of references to the fact that, you had a good job that you were able to go through every day, and now you were deprived of that. What were you doing before this?
Well, in my 20s, I was a gardener, and I worked for a seed company. I also did private gardening and landscaping. And then I actually did work in book publishing. I worked, I managed some book catalogs. So I had always wanted to write, but when I was healthy, I just, you know, I wanted to be out there in the world being physically active. So if you're sitting at a desk during the day, you come home at night and all you want to do is be outdoors. So, you know, when I got so ill, I was sort of at a point in my life where, you know, the only thing that is left for me to do is write. And luckily that was something I always wanted to do. But it was very difficult. It is very difficult to write with an illness. I think anyone knows how difficult it is to write anything creative or as long as a book. It's a huge challenge. And when you add physical limits into that challenge, it's really, really difficult.
You even had trouble reading. And tell us more about this illness. I mean, does it have a name? What exactly did cause it?
Yes, I have. It's caused by a pathogen, viral bacterial. It's unclear exactly what the pathogen was, and it caused a semi paralysis of my autonomic nervous system. It actually disrupted the metabolism in the mitochondria in all my cells, and the mitochondria convert when your cell needs to take food in and convert that to energy, the mitochondria are involved in that conversion. So if they're not working, your energy ability is completely zapped, and you can be profoundly weak. And the mitochondria are densest in cells in the body that are in muscle tissue, both the skeletal muscle tissue, which you use to move your arms and legs around, but also, even more importantly, the autonomic muscle, which includes your whole circulatory system, the blood vessels that circulate your blood, and your gastrointestinal system. So if your ability to circulate your blood is impaired, you can't be upright very easily. And if your gastrointestinal system is impaired, you can't eat very well. So the autonomic nervous system is absolutely critical to life and quality of life. It's much easier to rest your arm if the muscles get tired, but you can't ever rest your lungs or your circulation. And your muscle is a combination of skeletal and autonomic muscle. So it's very debilitating, and yet it's not very visible. You do look ill when you're so severely ill that you're bedridden, but you're not going to be moving in an unusual way. You just can't move much at all because you're so weak. So mitochondrial and autonomic dysfunction, and also a diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome, which came a little bit later. And chronic fatigue syndrome is very interesting right now. There's new research on a retrovirus involved in CFS. And in fact, a retrovirus can change, can cause mutations in DNA.
Wow.
And that can cause metabolic problems, can impact the mitochondria.
Yeah. In fact, you say something toward the end of the book that evolution has been profoundly influenced by viruses and other pathogens, I suppose exactly in this sense, although this would not be a mutation I think that would be advantageous.
Well, there are all kinds of mutations. Everybody has 10 or 12 mutations that are unique to them. We all walk around with mutations every day in our genes. You know, we're born with about a dozen mutations, and if you get the wrong virus, it can further zap a system, a mutation that might not have been harmful in conjunction with a particular pathogen can sort of bring your system down. But it's true, there are all kinds of viruses and bacteria, but some of them are perfectly good. In fact, the mitochondria in our cells are derived millions of years ago from bacteria. And they actually think that there are some viruses that increase our ability to be social animals and might even have been a lot of what led to our Homo sapiens species as a social species. So it's utterly fascinating. You can't just say that all pathogens are bad. And I'm glad you asked this question. It's one of the things that fascinates me the most. You know, the difference between a snail and a human may end up being a different history of pathogens.
Wow.
from a very early ancestor.
And that kind of commonality is something that underscores your book, or is a kind of a thread through it. It seems something that, I don't know if it had dawned on you before, but it certainly seems to be an idea that's very present to you, Elizabeth Tova Bailey, in this wonderful, wonderful book, The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. Just the sense of the common beingness of you and this snail, particularly you and this snail.
Yep, I was fascinated. You know, I'm not a scientist. I was an English lit major, but I did take a lot of science in college, geology and biology, and I loved it. And I was just sort of utterly fascinated by the fact that the snail was a terrestrial animal just like me. We both had a lung, we both had a heart, we both had a gut, and yet we were extremely different. I had dry skin, it had slimy skin, I had an internal skeleton, it had an external shell. And so I just felt just so puzzled by this combination of similarities and differences. And halfway through the book, I realized I was trying to, you know, answer my own questions about why illness exists as I was writing the book, and I came across some articles on the fact that viruses and pathogens are very involved in creating new species and how a species develops through history, and that just utterly fascinated me. And I had been trying to find some kind of a link to link together these, you know, this human, this snail, and my illness, and that was exactly the piece I needed. It was because of a pathogen that I was bedridden and watching a snail, and then it turned out it was because of pathogens that the snail and I had developed into such different, but also similar in many ways, creatures.
And even as individuals, I mean, there's a sense that there you are imprisoned in your bed because you can't move, and this snail is brought in, you know, taken out of its environment, brought in on a small pot, although then you had somebody create a terrarium for the snail. You have almost seems as if you entered into the consciousness of the snail through a shared sympathy.
I think I did. I definitely think I did. I was very careful. I didn't want to anthropomorphize anything. And yet at the same time, I think that as humans, we go too far in the other direction and try to look at animals only as science projects. And they are, as I discovered, both in watching my snail and in reading incredible amounts of material about gastropods and mollusks, that they, you know, any animal that has senses is going to react to what they like better and what they don't like as much. And that's, you can call it intuition, or as a human, you can call it decision-making. But I watched the snail go through a process of reviewing where, you know, deciding where it wanted to sleep, when its sleeping situation was comfortable. It let me know when its sleeping situation was not comfortable. If you put, you know, five kinds of food in front of the snail, it's going to choose what it wants to eat because it knows what it prefers. And any animal that has those kinds of preferences and likes and dislikes, you can't help but be aware that it's making those decisions on some level, whether it's innate or intuitive or not, and just knowing that it's going through that kind of a process of reviewing what's in front of it is just sort of fascinating, especially when you're looking at a snail. I mean, this isn't even a cat or a dog. But most of the, you know, some of the very most important work on memory has comes from research on snails. The snails have a memory. They can remember a new food for a month or two. Hmm. Who would think that a snail had a memory?
And what kind of food did the snail really like?
My snail liked portobello mushrooms.
And it actually got visibly happy when you first presented it with the portobello. Is that right?
Well, again, you know, I can say it was visibly interested. It when it smelled its first portobello mushroom that we put into the terrarium, its tentacles just began to wave in sort of slow motion. You know, I would interpret it as delight. It was clearly interested and went right over to the mushroom and began to eat. And it was so, you know, glad to see that mushroom that it slept right next to the mushroom for several days. You know, it would just wake up periodically and eat some more because it had, you know, at that point been quite a few weeks since it had had anything from its native habitat.
It was a whole lot better than paper.
Much better than paper. Snails have an enzyme that allows them to digest cellulose, an enzyme we don't have, so they actually can eat paper. I mean, they eat. Their niche in the woods is that of a decomposer. They will not eat a healthy plant leaf, but if a plant leaf is already ill or injured, then they'll eat it. They like something that's already partially decomposed, and then they have an enzyme that allows them to eat something that has cellulose in it.
And then you found that your snail actually had some babies.
It did. I don't want to give away too much of the plot.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't want to say too much, but I would say that circumstances occurred in the terrarium such that I did get into the romance and courtship of snails, and the Victorians had a lot to say about that, and snails have extraordinary love lives. There's no mammal that I or most scientists are aware of that has any kind of a love life as extraordinary as a snail.
And part of that seems to be it's just sheer tactile talent, let's say. I mean, snails, as you said before, they can smell, they can feel, they can't hear. So they are exquisitely sensitive.
That's right. I mean, you know, they're still in a world that's all sense-based, just with three senses. So those three senses become even more powerful. And, of course, they're responding to pheromones in almost everything in life. They're aware of pheromones. They can come across another snail's trail and know by the pheromones if it's a friend, you know, a snail of their species, or a foe, a snail species that might be dangerous, because there are a few that are cannibalistic. But those pheromones are also very important in finding a mate. So I would say that, you know, the love life of a snail is just as driven by pheromones as a human love life. And, you know, the irony is we're only discovering how important pheromones are in humans through science in the last few decades.
Yeah.
But they're probably more important than we ever realize. We think we're, as humans, that it has to do with, you know, discussions and talking and rationalization. But I think if you look at the animal world, you'll see how important pheromones are. And we are animals. Humans are just as much of an animal as any other.
Yeah, we forget that, don't we?
Yes. We also forget that we're not the most important species.
Elizabeth Tova Bailey, talking with us in 2011 about her book, The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. Hear the entire interview by going to writersvoice.net. We have just enough time for a poem. Here's Mary Oliver reading one of my favorite poems, Wild Geese.
You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things.
Mary Oliver reading Wild Geese. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.